Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Ann Clements. She has her PhD from Spurgeon's College. It was awarded in 2012. She is the author of a wonderful book that I encountered not long ago called Mothers on the Margin. Actually, there's a question mark there. Mothers on the Margin? Well, anyway, we'll get into that. And the subtitle is The Significance of Women in Matthew's Genealogy. Dr. Ann Clements. Ann, thanks for being with us today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, David.
Now, your book, it's a tremendous book. First of all, thank you for it. I'm going to be recommending it to people who are interested. And I know it's been a while since you've had a chance to write it, and you live with this for a number of years, like everybody that does a PhD. But where did this book come from? What's the big idea of your book?
Well, the book comes from a background in my own personal life. About 20 years ago now, I felt very strongly God calling me to ordained ministry. And at the time, a lot of people endorsed that, but there were several people who said, well, simply I couldn't have that calling because I was a woman. And that sent me back to the biblical text to really start digging deep. And at the same time, I was also auditing a course in feminist theology and came to the fact that the Bible was mainly androcentric. It was a lot about men. There were women in it, but mainly male-based and written against societies that were patriarchal. And so I had to think, okay, how do I deal with this text I had known and loved and cherished for years and years and years, and yet now I'm seeing new things. And so I eventually came to a place where I rejected the feminist hermeneutics of suspicion, because as a believing Christian, I felt that that wasn't appropriate.
Now, your background is Baptist, right?
Yeah. Okay. I'm an ordained Baptist minister.
Okay. All right. Very good.
I got to the point where I thought, no, I want to come to this text for an encounter. And I developed what I called a hermeneutics of hospitable awareness. I wanted to be hospitable to the text as a guest, as it were.
Right.
Welcome the text in. And the text, of course, has different aspects to it. Sometimes it can be really friendly. Sometimes it can be a little threatening. But I wanted to welcome the text in into an engagement, into a discourse, into an encounter.
And Matthew chapter 1, beginning in verse 1 down to verse 17, seemed to be a good place to do that.
Absolutely.
You know, so, you know, a lot of people, and everybody probably listening to the podcast has had a read through the Bible, right, program at some point, and they get to Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, and you get to this genealogy, and your eyes just glaze over, and you just say, we'll skip this part. You know, and we'll go on and everything.
But there's really
a lot to it, isn't there? I mean, there's a lot to this genealogy of these women in the New.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it just caught my attention because one of the things I wanted to do was to kind of retrieve some of the women's stories from the biblical text that perhaps we kind of skated over or hadn't seen as particularly significant. And I thought, well, Matthew sees these women, there are five women, obviously Mary is the last one, but four other Old Testament women he's put into the annotations of his genealogy. Well, why did he do that? Why did he include women? And why did he include those four women? And so that's what the question, the initial question that my thesis was dealing with.
So there are these women, including Mary at the very end, and they all have different stories to them. And I'm working on a book now called Matthew Through Old Testament Eyes. And the basic idea is if we really knew the Old Testament well, then how would we read Matthew differently? Yeah. And so when you come up to Tamar, when you come to Ruth, when you come to Rahab, when you come to the wife of Uriah, you know, these references here, what does that say to you, both as an interpreter, but also as a woman?
Well, I think that I was really challenged when I started rereading these women's stories from the Old Testament. Tamar, so not to get muddled up with the Princess Tamar, but Tamar, who was daughter-in-law to Judah, and then going on to Rahab, the prostitute. Ruth, you know, seen more in a positive light generally, and then Bathsheba, very ambiguous, you know, did she seduce David? Was she, you know, what, all this.
Right, right. So
I really wanted to go back and look at the Old Testament stories in detail and read them, well, through a woman's eyes. I, you know, I accept that I'm a woman reading it in my way, as it were. And just try to get to grips with exactly who these women were and what their Hebrew stories tell us about their character and their, you know, and their part they played in the whole messianic story.
There's a lot of women that are not included, right? For every Abraham beget, you know, Isaac, and Isaac beget Jacob, and all that begatting, women are involved in everything, right? But their names are not told, but we're not told about Sarah for that. He doesn't say Abraham beget Isaac through Sarah. Yeah. You know, he doesn't mention her, but he does mention Tamar. He does mention Rahab and these other women. What do you think Matthew is up to in doing so?
Well, you raise a very interesting question. Why doesn't he mention the ancestral mothers like Sarai? But he doesn't. I think he's pointing to several things here. I think the first three women. So we should mention that Matthew's genealogy is divided into three epochs, and so 14 generations each. So the first epoch goes from Abraham through to David. And in that first epoch, the first three women are mentioned. So you've got Tamar, you've got Rahab, and you've got Ruth. And they're all three women who are Gentiles, all three women who are in threatening positions in different ways. All three women, I claim, to be on the sort of margins of society in different ways. And I think Matthew is pointing us into the direction of where the Messiah is going to go in this kingdom of heaven that Jesus inaugurates. He reaches out to those on the margins. At the end of the gospel, he sends the disciples into all the world. And we see in Matthew that the women, who aren't mentioned that often throughout the gospel, but at the end of the gospel particularly, they are the only ones to witness in Matthew's gospel the crucifixion, Jesus' burial, and meet the resurrected Christ. And so I think Matthew is signaling that actually women are going to have a key place in this new kingdom of heaven alongside the men.
And in a sense, all women were on the margins of society, right, at that point, in some ways. What's wrong with the sort of the traditionalist view of these women, you know, that they are sexually promiscuous, et cetera? And that you said, where does that go back to?
Well, it goes right back to Jerome in 420. He calls the women reprehensible. And it continues with a lot of the church fathers. And they are all there to show that Jesus came to save sinners. And these women were archetypal sinners. And that's why they were put there.
Right, right. But Tamar is described as more righteous than Judah, right? At the end of the story, she's the one who has done what is right.
Yes, and it's Judah who recognizes that, actually.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go into that story a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I think that would be an interesting... I mean, of all the stories, I mean, that's the first one, and it's probably one that's least known.
I suspect you're right there, yes. I mean, if people do know about Tamar, they tend to talk about, oh, wasn't that the one who was a prostitute sort of thing?
Right, right.
So let me tell you a little bit about her story. Judah, as an Israelite, goes away from the family clan down into a different place, and he takes a wife for his eldest son, who's pretty probably a Canaanite, called Tamar. And we're just told that his eldest son, is evil, and therefore God does away with him. He kills him because he did evil. So then she's given to his second son, because in those, we think that the idea of the Levirate marriage, although probably not ensconced in law, was a practice. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to continue the name of her dead husband, she needed to have a son. Therefore, she was given to his second son, Onan. But Onan knew that if he fathered a son, it wouldn't be his. It would be essentially continuing his brother's line. And so basically he uses Tamar for sex, but he practiced coitus interruptus, so she doesn't have a child. Mm-hmm. And we're told that God sees this, and although other people wouldn't have seen it, God does, and he also dies. So Judah, the father, thinks, goodness me, this woman's got a jinx on her. Both my sons have died.
Right, right.
She hasn't had any children. Although, interestingly, her name means fruit palm. So,
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He sends her back to her father's house. She's, if you like, a widow in waiting. He says, look, when my youngest son, Sheila, grows up, I will give him to you. She goes back to her father's house. So he has to provide for her economically, in disgrace, as it were. And she waits and waits and waits. She can't get married because she's a Levirate widow. And eventually she realizes that when his son's grown up, he hasn't been given to her. So she takes things into her own hands at this stage. Mm-hmm. She hears that Judah is going up for the sheep shearing, and she places herself at a crossroads where she'll be noticed, and she dresses up as a prostitute. Judah takes the bait. He goes in, he sleeps with her, but she's very clever. She says, I want you to give me some sort of pledge here. And he basically gives her the equivalent of his passport. It's his seal and his cord and his staff.
Okay.
And she sleeps with him. Then she goes away. She takes off the sort of prostitute's clothing, puts back her widow's clothing. And then he is told a few months later that his daughter-in-law, of course, he hasn't recognized her at all, is pregnant. Mm. And he says, well, she's got to be burned. And the Hebrew tells us, as she is being brought out to be burned, she produces the seal, the cord, and the proof, and said, this is the man by whom I am pregnant. And of course,
so like you said, Judah. The passport. Here's the passport of the guy.
Here's the passport. So she is carrying this. Judah's own children, his progeny. And he realizes that she's more righteous than I am, because I didn't give her my son in marriage, in Levirate marriage, so she could continue the line. Mm. And she actually has twin sons, Perez and Zerah. And, you know, God blesses her in that way. And she actually is able to continue the line through, and therefore God's promises and his hope for the future through what she's done. So some people could say, well, that's a terrible thing she did. But I argue, what other choice did she have?
Yeah. When you think about these women being on the margin, when you think about these women being, they were not treated well. in the case of David, King David, let's say, David fathered Solomon through the wife of another man. Yeah. His name is Uriah, and he's a Hittite. So that's maybe one of the more famous stories there. Yeah. But Matthew didn't need necessarily, because genealogies in those days typically didn't include the names of women. He didn't need necessarily to bring out that moment and to remind us of that in such a dramatic way. David fathered Solomon through a woman who belonged to another man. Yeah. Right? That's pretty scandalous, right?
It is. And he could have just said Bathsheba. But he didn't. He said the wife of Uriah. In fact, when Bathsheba actually had Solomon, by that stage she was David's wife. Mm. But previously, of course, she'd been the wife of Uriah when She'd been bathing. Uriah had been at war with all the troops, but David hadn't gone with them. Significantly, he had stayed in Jerusalem, and after his afternoon siesta, he was walking on the roof, and from the high point of his palace, sees this woman bathing and sees her, lusts after her, sends for her, sleeps with her. And we're told significantly she was going through her monthly bathing ritual to purify herself, which is an indicator to me of what the narrator thinks about Bathsheba in all this. And, you know, David then by proxy, after a long ins and outs with getting Uriah back and trying to get him to sleep with his wife, and he fails to do so, orders his commander to put Uriah right at the front line, murders him by proxy. He then marries, she's pregnant, he marries Bathsheba, but the child sadly dies, and David fasts and, you know, pleased with God for that child's life.
Exactly, yeah.
But in the end, the second child born is Solomon, beloved of the Lord. Mm. And it's through Solomon, of course, the line continues. So to me, that speaks, the wife of Uriah speaks of David's sinfulness, if you like, but also of God's incredible gracious forgiveness in the second son being the one to continue the messianic line.
Yeah. And one of the things I point out in a variety of ways through the Gospel of Matthew is that Jesus is a friend of sinners, right?
Yeah.
The people who think they're righteous, people who think that they're okay, in fact, find themselves not okay. Sometimes it is the tax collector and the prostitute and the big S sinner, not just all of us have sin, but the notorious sinners who might make it into the kingdom before others.
Yes,
that seems to be a part of Matthew's story there. Now let's come to Mary, who's the mother of Jesus. You say in your book that she's most like Bathsheba, who's not named. Why do you think Mary is most like Bathsheba?
I ought to just say that I'm looking here at Bathsheba just in the text of Samuel, she, not in her portrayal as in 1 Kings, where I think as Queen Mother she's portrayed in quite a different way. But Mary in Matthew, not, and again, very different than the way she's given to us in Luke, narratively, they're very similar. So they both are very passive in their stories. Mary says absolutely nothing in Matthew's gospel, in the first few chapters of Matthew. And Bathsheba just says the two words which tip the whole David story, I'm pregnant. But both, so they're similar in that sense, but they are also similar in that they're both pregnant outside of marriage. And they're both in very threatening situations. You know, Bathsheba is pregnant from a man who's not a husband. Mary, we're told, is pregnant from the Holy Spirit and not yet married. And we all know that story. So they could have, you know, both lives were under threat. And yet both women give birth to, if you like, sons of David. In Matthew, Jesus is portrayed again and again as the son of David who heals. And
that's right, yeah.
You know, Bathsheba gives birth to the first son of David, and if you like, Mary gives birth to the last son of David, and they're both beloved of the Lord. So I think there are similarities there in their stories.
Now, you have become a Baptist minister, so I take it that those people who did not endorse the fact you were called to ministry, you didn't continue to listen to them.
Well, the way the Baptist Church works in this country is that the church as a whole, in fact, all the members have to vote to endorse the person to go forward for training.
I see. Okay.
And so I actually had to face the whole church meeting and be grilled for about 45 minutes. And then I left the room, and they voted overwhelmingly to endorse me to go forward to ministry.
Now, is that called ordination there?
Yes.
That's called ordination. Okay.
Yes.
But that just says that this particular church is ordaining you and endorsing you.
Oh, sorry. No. That's just the initial stage to enable me to then train. and finally be ordained at the end of training.
I see.
Before you can even start training, you have to have the endorsement of your local church.
I see. Good. Okay. That helps me in terms of understanding that. Bottom line here from your book, and as we leave the podcast, what should women and men take away from the genealogy, you think, in Matthew?
I think they should take away that as the people of God, we are called to look out for those that are apparently on the margins of society. I think we should all take away the fact that I think God calls us through Matthew and through many other parts of the Bible to a discipleship of men and women who are both made in the image of God. And I think particularly in the whole Black Lives Matter issue at the moment, we need to welcome everybody in, whoever they are, whatever their background, whatever we might sort of think of them in terms of our initial impressions. Mm-hmm. We are all called to embrace them into the church and together to reflect the image of God.
Wonderful. Dr. Ann Clements, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Thank you, David.
I want to thank Dr. Ann Clements for being with us today here on the Stone Chapel. She's written a wonderful book called Mothers on the Margin, The Significance of the Women in Matthew's Genealogy. It's published by Pickwick Publications, and I hope you'll go out and take a look and buy that book and read it. It's really a terrific contribution. Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.